This is our final class during this visit. So, two more verses about the lotus feet, though. That's consistent. What did we speak about this morning in relation to the Lord's lotus feet? Who can recall? A little louder. Theory of reflection, you remember that part, and personalism. What? There's obstacles in realizing lotus feet, and what are there's two categories that were mentioned.
Accepting things that are favorable and rejecting things that are unfavorable.
That's called surrender to Krishna. Those are principles of surrender to Krishna. What are two obstacles in realizing or seeing the Lord's lotus feet?
Too much attachment
for
material enjoyment
or materialistic activities. Another is impersonalism. Yeah, the offensiveness that comes from having a fundamental misconception about the oneness of living entities in God. And that's where this theory of reflection comes in. So an impersonal conception of God, that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught the same as it's taught here in Srimad Bhagavatam, that this is an offense, or the greatest offense is to deny the existence of the Lord as separate from the individual souls, or to accept the Lord as the individual, the Lord and the individual soul are one and the same. It's just the verse way of saying the same thing. They're not separate, or they're the same. So that's an offensive attitude, and that offensive attitude blocks, as does being too much affected, too much attached to materialistic activities. It blocks one's seeing of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. The process of bhakti can overcome material affinity, provided one is willing to let go. But impersonal conception, or the offense of impersonalism, makes it very difficult for the offender to accept devotional service and get the benefit. So now, the two verses that follow are kind of a compare and contrast duo about the path of bhakti and the path of jnana. So let's do a little Bhagavad Gita 101 quiz. And what's the distinction? On this column is, so we have our nice chart. Here's bhakti is over here and jnana is over here. What can we say about bhakti in contrast with jnana? And then we'll go to 201, Srimad Bhagavatam, these two verses. So this is the undergraduate level. Bhakti and jnana, what can we say about these two? How do they compare and contrast? Anyone?
Practicing bhakti automatically leads to jnana and vairagya.
Did you hear what he said? You did. I could barely hear what you said.
Bhakti leads to jnana and vairagya.
Oh, okay. And what would you say about jnana?
It's like a milestone and bhakti is the goal.
Oh, okay, but not quite. Not quite. I'll say the same thing differently. Bhakti leads to karma, to knowledge and detachment, vairagya and jnana. Or the basis and support of knowledge and detachment is bhakti. Over here is without bhakti, you're not going to have true jnana. Bhakti is independent, Gyan is dependent. Would you agree? It's okay? You want to modify it at all? No, it's okay. Okay. What would you say? Bhakti, Gyan. You're going to follow the chart, right?
Yeah.
Bhakti and Gyan, compare and contrast.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm not certain about just putting it in front. Gyan leads to pride, bhakti leads to humility. Is that something that we can say? Or?
Not necessarily. Because one who is following properly the process of Gyan, yoga, there's some element of bhakti, and therefore it also will lead to the you know, bahunam janmanam ante gyanavan mam prapadyate. But you could say Gyan at best, leads to impersonal liberation, and bhakti directly leads to personal association with the Lord in the liberated state. Or bhakti is performed on the platform of liberation and connects him with the personal feature of the Supreme. What's the verse from Bhagavad Gita that supports that statement I just made? And paraphrase the translation. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Na Sochati Na Kangsati.
There's no lamentation or hankering. There's no such Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma in the stage of Brahman.
One who has attained this stage of Brahman feels great happiness where there is no hankering or lamenting for things material.
Sama Sarvesha, there is equal.
They see all living entities equally. In such a state, they at once attain my devotional service. A little help. Yeah. Good. So at best, Gyan can attain moksha, sarsayuja, that type of liberation. And bhakti is already on the platform of liberation and provides one the opportunity to attain personal liberation or association with the personality of Godhead in the Vaikuntha realm. Any other? Compare, contrast. Go ahead.
Bhakti is the path of mercy. It's dependent on mercy. But Gyan is the path of deliverance.
Your sentence trailed off at the end. I lost you.
Bhakti is the path of mercy, but Gyan is the path of endeavor.
Very good. Would you agree? That's it. Yes, yes, no, or maybe.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Okay. You want to edit what he just said?
Is Gyan is a part of mental speculation? Or?
No. Let's just stay with what he said. The path of personal endeavor. So what effort that we make is what you get out of Gyan. Now you said bhakti is the path of mercy, right? There's the endeavor also required.
Yes.
Yes. So it's the path of endeavor plus mercy. And the other is the path of endeavor. The math is real simple. This one's stronger. Okay, you were going to say?
Same thing.
How are you going to say it?
I thought mental speculation.
Keep the volume up.
Mental speculation is also a part of personal endeavor, so that automatically adds to this.
Okay. Any other compare contrast? Yeah.
In bhakti that's more transcendental knowledge, that is realized knowledge, just, but in jnana it's more just knowledge.
Do you have some scriptural authority for that? Or?
Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, transcendental knowledge.
And? What's the verse? Okay. There's a verse in the 18th chapter that describes the position of a brahmana. It includes both jnanam and vijnanam. You know the verse, right? Sama dhammaktapakshocham shantir arjam evacha jnanam vijnanam astakyam brahma karma svabhavajam. So, the position from which one engages in the activities of a brahmana is from the position of knowledge, but also realized knowledge, theoretical and applied. A properly qualified brahmana doesn't just theoretically know things. He lives by that and can direct others how to live according to those standards, proper standards. And a brahmana may or may not be a Vaishnava. So one can become realized in Brahman, not just theoretically. One can become realized in Brahman. But that Brahman realization coming out of Gyan is partial realization, not complete realization. But it's realization, it's not just theoretical. Okay, but to go back to what you said, theoretical and realized. And I'm sounding the buzzer. It means that's not exactly correct. The realization, you can say realization is not complete, realization is complete. Gyan and bhakti. Realization of Brahman and realization of Bhagavan, where the realization is. Yeah. Right? As far as the absolute truth or the features of the absolute truth. Because one who knows Bhagavan will also have understanding of Paramatma and Brahman. But one who understands Brahman may not also understand Paramatma and Bhagavan. We're going to stay on compare and contrast, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Is it possible to say that a jnana yogi renounces all activities and just...
Karma sannyas.
Yes. Yeah. It leads to karma sannyas while bhakti you practice in whichever, or whatever position you are in.
Okay. Yukta vairagya. Well, just... So it's clear. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Maharaj.
Yeah. So then we can say those eligible for realization in Gyan are only those who are sannyasis. You know, like Shankaracharya said, if you're a grihastha, forget it. If you want to make spiritual advancement, take sannyas. And that you, then you can begin. But if you're not ready for that, then you can't make spiritual progress. That's the teaching, and that's the way of life in that impersonal monistic path. And the bhakti process is Arjuna as a grihastha, kshatriya, and engaged in warfare can achieve spiritual perfection as much as one who's a sannyasi, because he's fully engaging whatever he has at his disposal in Krishna's service, Yukta Vairagya principle. Okay. Yes?
Maharaj, we can say that bhakti is a simple process, whereas jnana is a very complicated process.
Yes.
So one can become, can perfect his life in a moment in bhakti, because it's not possible to perfect one's life in a moment.
Yeah, both of those. Those are two different statements. Because complicated can be resolved quickly, but it's what it has to do with this path of mercy. Similarly, it's possible to do immediately because of Krishna's mercy, along with our endeavor. But the beginning of the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which type of worship do you recommend, is Arjuna's question. And the reasons that you just gave why Krishna says the impersonal is very difficult. It's unnatural. It's very complicated for the embodied soul to accomplish that, fixing their mind on the impersonal feature. Very, very difficult. So are you saying that one can become a perfected jnani with as much enviousness as he likes?
No, that's what I don't know, because I've not read that. I know only for bhakti that it is required non-enviousness.
And why? Why is it required for bhakti?
Because that's when we can be a surrendered servant.
Yeah, how can you surrender if you have envy towards that person who you're to surrender to? So, is it possible for a jnani to be free from envy? A jnani who is successful?
Yeah, I heard because people who get revelated and go to the Brahman state, there's still a chance when we are in the community they can fall down because they again want enjoyment. That enjoyment tendency comes from still having some kind of envy.
It's enjoying tendency. Is there part of the soul, because we're part and parcel of the Supreme, and the Supreme is the Supreme Enjoyer, we have the tendency to be happy. It's natural to the soul. But having not taken shelter, Aruya Krichchena Param Padam Tada Patantyado, Nadmada Yushvat Angriya, having not taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord when again falls, having not taken shelter. So we can say that much. The path of bhakti requires the envious spirit such that one can take shelter of lotus feet of the Lord. Again, he has not taken shelter, or it's the path of endeavor. And why aren't they willing to take shelter of the Lord? Because they have an impersonal conception of him. You can say enviousness, or at least you can say, as Prabhupada is saying here, offensiveness. Just the unwillingness, fundamental unwillingness to accept there's God and there's a living entity and the living entity should surrender to him. I don't like that concept, or it's not a right concept. There's only one thing, so there's no need for surrender. There's no such thing as surrender. The surrender means unto something else, and all there is one. All there is oneness. It's a fundamental misconception. Okay, so here's what the demigods have to say on this topic, and then our acharyas in their purport. Text number 46 and 47. O Lord, this is the bhakti group comes first. Persons who, because of their service attitude, attain the stage of enlightened devotional service, achieve the complete meaning of renunciation and knowledge, and attain Vaikuntha Loka in the spiritual sky, simply by drinking the nectar of your topics. We spoke about the importance of Krishna Katha or Hari Katha, the importance of hearing purport. The difference between the impersonalistic mental speculators and the pure devotees of the Lord is that the former, impersonalist speculators, pass through a miserable understanding of the Absolute Truth at every stage, whereas the devotees enter into the kingdom of all pleasures, even from the beginning of their attempt. Marmabhuta Prasanatma. The devotee has only to hear about devotional activities, which are as simple as anything in ordinary life, and he also acts very simply, whereas the mental speculator, he has to pass through a jugglery of words, which are partially facts and partially make show for the maintenance of an artificial impersonal status. In spite of his strenuous efforts to attain perfect knowledge, the impersonalist attains merging into the impersonal oneness of the Brahmajyoti of the Lord, which is also attained by the enemies of the Lord, simply because of their being killed by him, like Shishupal. What happened to Shishupal when he was... his vocal cords were cut by Sudarshan after 100 times offending Krishna. His soul left his body and hovered in the air, and right in that same assembly entered into the body of Krishna. Sayuja Mukti. Oh, Prabhupada is referring to that as, well, there's a specific example, but those who are killed by the Lord in the Lord's presence, or like those who gave up their lives in the Kurukshetra battlefield in the Lord's presence, they achieve liberation. Duryodhana achieved liberation. Shishupal achieved liberation. So why aspire for the same thing, merging into the existence of the Supreme, after so much difficulty, by a process that's so unnatural, very, very difficult, just as Krishna says in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. The devotees, however, attain the highest stage of both knowledge and renunciation. That was mentioned in a previous verse, but it's also mentioned in the first canto. Vasudeva Bhagavati. You know the verse? Very good. You know the verse too? Say it together. Gyanam cha yad ahaitukam. Gyanam cha yad ahaitukam. So, two things ahaitukam causelessly. Hetu means cause. Ahetu or ahaituki means without cause. Without cause, both knowledge and detachment arise from Krishna Bhakti, or Vasudeva Bhakti. So, a devotee doesn't have to go to jnana class or vairagya class. They have to engage in devotional service, and through the medium of devotional service, knowledge awakens. Part of that process of knowledge awakening is what we're doing. We're reading Srimad Bhagavatam, but we're not reading Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita like a jnani. It's devotion. We're hearing and describing the glories of the Supreme Lord. Here's the glories of the Lord's lotus feet. They illumine the heart of the devotee. And by hearing those glories, the heart becomes awakened. The original quality of the soul becomes awakened. The original quality of the soul is situated in knowledge, in particular knowledge of Krishna and all things in relation to Krishna. When the light goes on, you can see all things in a dark room. And when the light's out, you can't see those dark things. You can't see the things because of the darkness, excuse me. So by awareness of Krishna, one becomes aware of things in relation to Krishna. Knowledge is causelessly awakened. So the devotees attain in contrast with impersonal speculation, attain the highest stage of knowledge and renunciation and achieve the Vaikuntha lokas, the planets in the spiritual sky. That is to say, the impersonalist attains only the sky and does not achieve any tangible transcendental bliss, whereas the devotee attains to the planets where real spiritual life prevails. There's a verse by Jamunacharya which makes the comparison between the happiness of impersonal liberation and the happiness of devotion to the Supreme Lord. And the comparison is the amount of water that's in the hoofprint of a calf compared to the amount of water that's in a whole ocean. How much water is in the hoofprint of a calf compared to the water in a whole ocean? It's insignificant. So the happiness of Brahmananda, the happiness of realization of Brahman, it's a state of neutrality where basically it's minus the kleshas, the sufferings of material existence. It's likened to banging your head against the wall and then stopping. Ah, what a relief. But the positive happiness isn't what's found in relief. Relief is just, you know, the stopping of some negative thing. But the positive happiness, so in the spiritual sky, is the absence of the sufferings of material existence, the kleshas of material existence. But so that's the Brahma Bhuta, the happiness of the Brahman platform. But from the Brahman platform, one can be engaged in devotional service. Or devotional service is automatically from the Brahman platform, where one then contacts the personality of Godhead, or here is spoken of in terms of the Vaikuntha lokas, the planets in that spiritual sky, that are the fullness of Sat, Chit, and Ananda. In the Brahman, the Chit feature alone is realized. The existence of the Supreme feature is realized. The Supreme exists. And what is the Supreme? It's the absence of material misery. And that happiness is compared to the amount of happiness in the hoofprint of a calf, the water in the hoofprint of a calf, compared to the whole ocean. Anandam buddhi vardhanam. Where real spiritual life and real spiritual happiness prevails. With a serious attitude, the devotee throws away all achievements like so much dust, the achievements of Sayuja Mukti, and he accepts only devotional service, the transcendental culmination. There's nice prayers like that in Nectar Devotion, that if the devotee is given the opportunity, would you like the opulence of heavenly existence? No, thank you. Unless there's service to the Supreme Lord to do there. What about liberation? No, thank you. Without the opportunity for serving the Supreme Lord, what's the use of liberation? Liberation? Any position whatsoever, a blade of grass, a speck of dust, whatever, some opportunity to serve the Supreme Lord, because the happiness derived therein is compared to the other kinds of heavenly happiness or the happiness of liberation. There's no comparison. So here's the other side. That's the bhakti side. Here's the jnana side. Others, this is text 47, others who are pacified by means of transcendental self-realization, that's this neutral state, and have conquered over the modes of nature by dint of strong power and knowledge, also enter into you, but for them there is so much pain. whereas the devotee simply discharges devotional service and thus feels no such pain. Anybody want some pain or no pain? Which medicine would you like? That's an easy choice. Purport. In terms of a labor of love and its returns, the bhaktas, or the devotees of the Lord, always have propriety over persons who are addicted to the association of jnanis or impersonalists and yogis or mystics. The word appare, meaning others, is very significant in this connection. Others, appare, refers to the jnanis and the yogis whose only hope is to merge into the existence of the impersonal Brahmajyoti. Although their destination is not so important in comparison to the destination of the devotees, the labor of the non-devotees is far greater than that of the bhaktas. One may suggest that there is sufficient labor for the devotees also in the matter of discharging devotional service, but that labor is compensated by the enhancement of transcendental pleasure, the pleasure of love. The devotees derive more transcendental pleasure while engaging in continuously in the service of the Lord than when they have no such engagement. In the family combination of a man and woman, there is much labor and responsibility for both of them, and yet, when they are single, they feel more trouble for the want of their united activities. In other words, in relationships there may be something that we do for one another that looks like, oh, that's a burden. But when there's love, then it's a burden of love and it's not just something horrible. Paragraph. The union of the impersonalists and the union of the devotees is not on a par. The impersonalists try to fully stop their individuality by attaining sayujya mukti, or unification, by merging into oneness, whereas the devotees keep their individuality to exchange feelings in relationship with the supreme individual, Lord. Such reciprocation of feelings takes place in the transcendental Vaikuntha planets, and therefore the liberation sought by the impersonalists is already achieved in devotional service. The devotees attain mukti automatically, while continuing the transcendental pleasure of maintaining individuality. As explained in the previous verse, the destination of the devotees is Vaikuntha, or Akuntadishnya, the place where anxieties are completely eradicated. One should not mistake the destination of the devotees and that of the impersonalists to be one and the same. The destinations are distinctly different, and the transcendental pleasure derived by the devotee is also distinct from chinmatra, or spiritual feelings alone. So what's being said here similarly is the some of the same things that we summarized before. And the path of Gyan, so the compare and contrast. The path of Gyan, just as we heard, is dependent upon one's endeavor. And that endeavor must be very, very intense and strong and severe and sustained in many cases over many lifetimes to achieve the stage of liberation. And the path of Bhakti is some endeavor needs to be made, and there's dependence upon the mercy of the Lord. And with that mercy of the Lord, because the devotee is trying to, depending upon the Supreme, please Him and serve Him and connect with Him in that loving mood, there's reciprocation from the Lord. It's not partiality, it's a question of reciprocation of one's disposition. Like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Yayatam mam prapadyante. Who said? You know the verse? ye tamam prapadyante tam stataiva pajamyaham mama vartmana vartante something. Okay, what does that mean? As they prapadyante, as they surrender unto me, I reciprocate. I reward them accordingly. So someone over here in Gyan says, it's my effort alone. Reciprocation, okay. Your effort alone. Over here, the path of Gyan. My effort, but I'm very dependent upon the mercy of the Lord. Reciprocation. Okay, you want the mercy of the Lord? Here's my mercy. Combine that with your effort. Which is better? Which is going to be stronger? The math is simple. Which is exactly what Krishna says in this 12th chapter when comparing. Because he helps one. And we need all the help we can get. Especially in spiritual, but in any undertaking, we need kind assistance from qualified person. So, what more qualified person is there than the Supreme Person? So, there's the effort that's required, and then there's the attainment that's reached. One is, after many, many births and deaths, maybe one will come to the stage of spiritual perfection. There's this other verse, Bahunam. No. What is it? Out of many thousands, Manushanam Sahasreshu Kaschit Yatati Siddhaye Yatitam Api Siddhanam Kashchin mam veti tatvataha. Out of many thousands of persons who are endeavoring for perfection, maybe one will achieve perfection. And perfection is detaching oneself from the material conception, becoming situated in the spiritual conception. And then, out of many, many thousands of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows Krishna in truth. So, achieving that siddhi, siddhaye, or perfection of spiritual realization, realization of Brahman, realization of our spiritual identity, distinct from the illusory identity that we're not, there's another stage. And so the attainment of Brahman realization by the jnani and the attainment of Vaikuntha Loka by the devotee, they're not, as Prabhupada said, it's not in the same par. The happiness in Vaikuntha is complete. And the happiness of cessation of illusion and banging your head against the wall is incomplete. There's a happiness. Stop banging your head against the wall. But what's the positive happiness of a healthy being that doesn't bang his head against the wall? What do you do? What's that happiness? Vaikuntha happiness is the outcome for the devotee. I wanted to read how Vishvanath Chakravarti Thakur treats this purport, or the verse in his commentary. And I hope it comes up. There we go. I'm going to read there's three parts to his commentary. There's a short little paragraph, like two sentences long. Then he makes some scriptural references from Srimad Bhagavatam to support that first little paragraph. And then he makes a summary that's like 10 sentences long. So, Here's the introduction, summary, two sentences. By the practice of jnana, the process of making the mind steady, atma samadhi, or by ashtanga yoga, so by the path of yoga or jnana, they enter into you, the Supreme Lord, so sayujya. They attain sayujya. But to do this, they become exhausted by great effort. If they perform bhakti, they do not become fatigued. Then there's two verses. One is from Lord Brahma's prayers in the 10th canto, 14th chapter. After he steals the calves and the cowherd boys, he makes some prayers. Here's one. My Lord, devotional service unto you is the best path for self-realization. If someone gives up that path and engages in the cultivation of speculative knowledge, he will simply undergo a troublesome process and will not achieve his desired result. As a person who beats an empty husk of wheat cannot get grain, but one who simply speculates cannot achieve self-realization. His only gain is trouble. So you have chaff, and you thrash the chaff, because the grain has already been removed. What do you get? Your own labor. No grain, just labor. Similarly, Lord Brahma is comparing the effort of speculative knowledge, the ascending process of trying to figure it out, understand the Supreme by speculative powers. It produces nothing other than one's own labor exercise to achieve that. Or, also from that same 14th chapter, Canto 10, O Almighty Lord, in the past, many yogis in this world, so jnana and then yoga, many yogis in this world achieved the platform of devotional service by offering all their endeavors unto you and faithfully carrying out their prescribed duties. Through such devotional service, perfected by processes of hearing and chanting about you, they came to understand you, O Infallible One, and could easily surrender to you and achieve your supreme abode. So between the two, jnana and bhakti, bhakti is much more easy and much more direct. So that's the two verses, along with the introduction. Now here's his, it's a little complicated, just listen carefully. It's nice understanding. From this it is understood that without bhakti, it is impossible to achieve jnana, or to speak of liberation. Remember this one? Jnana is dependent upon bhakti. To have jnana effective, it has to be jnana yoga. To have it jnana yoga, there has to be bhakti. Support something, some element of devotion to the Supreme. Whereas bhakti stands independent. Without any other asset, jnana and vairagya come from bhakti. So bhakti is independent and jnana is dependent upon bhakti. Thus they suffer extremely. For them, only suffering and nothing else remains. Klesha laha. This is like beating on empty husk. By means of bhakti, which is an anga of jnana, they attain sayujya. But in the stage of practice, it is clear that there is great effort in searching out the method of concentrating the mind. Same as 12th chapter. How do you fix your mind on that which has no qualities, has no form, it's descriptionless? You can fix your mind on that. Very troublesome. Impossible. Great effort is required in searching out the method of concentrating the mind on the impersonal feature. In the state of perfection, they accept merging into the Lord, which is rejected by the devotees who attain prema, which is the cause of controlling you. That choice also is only suffering. According to the devotees, the jnanis in liberation suffer. And to explain that, he says, quote, "But it should be inferred that devotees also become tired in serving the Lord." This verse says, they do not become tired by serving. The proof is the experiencer is a bhakti. There are no difficulties for men or women or for persons in any ashram, but even in not having difficulties, there is some sort of pain, for by not attaining service, the devotees suffer greatly. One should not think that by serving you, the devotees enter into you, for this contradicts the previous verse which states that devotees attain you, the abode of no fatigue, akunta dishnyam. Anyway, it's doing subtleties here of the particular language that's used. And based on the particular language, there's appropriate or an inappropriate understanding. So his comment here is that in any ashram, one, or in any status of life, just like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, striyo vaishas tata shudras tepiyanti param gatim, that the stage of param gatim, that supreme goal, the highest perfection of life, can be attained by, regardless of your body, regardless of your ashram, regardless of your gender, regardless of the material circumstances of life, by taking shelter of the personality of Godhead, by hearing about him, by that very simple natural process, all souls can become elevated. Or like you were saying, it's not that there you must perform karma sannyas, renounce the world as false. Or as they say in common English, is renounce all your worldly possessions. You have to become a monk in the English way of regarding this. You have to become a sannyasi in the Vedic way of looking at things. And otherwise, no spiritual progress, like we spoke before. That's how impersonalists view. And that's one of the reasons why, because of the prominence of impersonalism, that people think when you start getting serious about spiritual life, you have to become a renunciate. You have to give up the world. You have to stop your education. You have to stop, doing ordinary things of life. And you have to go live in a monastery. You have to go live in Sringeri Math in South India and become a sannyasi. Otherwise, there's one family member. I can't remember which family. There's somebody that lives in South India, and for want of association with devotees, the father in the family has had impersonal association. He just left the family. Do you know who this person is? You know who I'm referring to? Somebody that's just a devotee was describing. Their father just like left his mother to go live in Sringeri Math and just left, for want of association with hearing the process that's described in Bhagavad Gita. I mean, if someone wants to do that, that's fine, but they shouldn't do that out of, with a misunderstanding or out of frustration either. If that's appropriate and one's worldly responsibilities are being maintained, fine. But it's not the platform. Like Arjuna was ready to do that. Arjuna was ready to go to the mountains and live a cave and give up Draupadi and Kunti and his brothers and just become a mendicant. And Krishna said, no. You perform your prescribed duty and always think of me. And that's the method, yukta vairagya, as you were saying, rather than karma sannyas. And by that method, one can attain Vaikuntha, the place where there's no fatigue, akunta dishnyam, And full variety of spiritual activity is found there. Okay. Well, I must say that during this visit, you all have been like really super as far as asking lots of questions. Made it really easy. So let's see if you have some questions this evening. It's 8:30. Yes?
In the previous lectures, you described that personalism is very natural and easy to practice. Then how does one become impersonal? Like, if it is very natural and easy to be personal, why does one resort to impersonal conception?
Well, if you're looking for a good reason, there isn't one. It's rebelliousness. It's why we've come to the material world to begin with. Why did we come to the material world to begin with? Rebellious spirit. How come he's always the enjoyer? Like this position of envy that we're speaking about before. How come always him? I want to be the center. At least some of the time. You know, some of the time. It's only fair. He can be, then I can be. You know, we'll share. But, you know, I want to enjoy. I want to be the center. And there's a problem. Somebody else is the center. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes raga, dvesha, samudhena, dvandva, mohena, bharata. Dvandva, moha, the duality of delusion. Is the reward for those who have raga and dvesha. They covet the position of being God, and they have an aversion to he who is actually God, because I want to sit on the throne, but there's somebody already on the throne. So we come to the material world with that aversion. Although it's natural to take the position of accepting one who's worshipping God. We have an aversion for that. So we try enjoying through illusion. The kingdom of Maya is created for us to try to give us the facility to enjoy independently, which can't happen. And we can try to make it happen in illusion. But it's only illusion. It can't happen. And when we become frustrated, we still have the desire to be, you know, sitting on the throne. So philosophically, we come up with this bright idea that says, I'm God. I was trying to be God before. I'm just trying it in a different way now. The enjoyer of Prakriti or the renouncer of Prakriti. But that's both illusion. It's not ours to renounce. Nor are we equal to in all respect with the Supreme. That's impersonalism. So why do people do that? Because it's a diseased condition. It's the rebellious spirit coming out in a different way. Impersonalism is born out of frustration with trying to be the enjoyer, which we can't. Vitaraga bhaya krodha in Bhagavad Gita Krishna describes. One has to overcome these three things, raga, bhaya, and krodha. Krodha is anger, frustration. I tried to enjoy, it didn't work. I'm frustrated. Let me just become one with the Supreme and try that way. Instead of trying to be the enjoyer independently. Yes.
Maharaj, we have read that in Prabhupada's books that self-realization and God-realization happen simultaneously.
Yeah.
So, when a person is in the Brahman platform, is he what?
Partial. To say simultaneously, it still requires an understanding that it's gradual. The example that Prabhupada gives to say simultaneously is It's if the room is completely dark and you put a mirror before your face, what do you see? Nothing, because it's completely dark. But as the sun rises, you can simultaneously see the light of the sun and you can see your face in the mirror. But even that's gradual, or you know, proportionate to the sun's rising, you can see yourself. So the Brahman realized person is partial. They haven't fully realized themselves, nor have they fully realized the Supreme. There's a partial realization of the Sat feature. And a complete realization of the Sat feature is Satchitananda in its completeness. So it's an incomplete stage of realization. And so the self is, because the self is not simply apart from Parabrahman, Brahman, or the spark apart from the fire, or the drop apart from the ocean, or the part of the body from the whole body. We're part and parcel of the Supreme. That's a complete realization. To realize that we're not this body, we're Brahman, is not yet a complete realization. But it's in relation to the Supreme. They wouldn't have that realization without some realization of the Supreme. It's a partial realization of the Supreme. Yes?
I thought I meant to ask this question out of curiosity.
Okay.
When you were mentioning about people who leave, who renounce everything, basically, worldly pleasures.
Yeah. All worldly possessions.
All worldly.
Even your Penn State sweatshirt.
Okay. I have seen one kind of people that do that. They do that to kind of, as a kind of escapism.
Yeah.
That was what you just mentioned. If a person wanted to genuinely renounce everything, then at that point, what would be his mental state?
Okay.
If I'm able to articulate properly.
Let me respond by saying, respond to your question by asking a question. For such a person, whoever that theoretical person is, what is it? What is theirs to renounce? I'll say it in Sanskrit. Rupa Goswami writes two verses in Sanskrit where he says, I'll paraphrase, there's yukta vairagya and markata vairagya. There's phalgo vairagya. Phalgo vairagya is false renunciation. So if I give up something that isn't mine, it's a false renunciation. I walk out in the, you know, from the apartment here, and I see all these nice cars, and there's a this one or that one. I say, I renounce this one, I renounce that one. What's mine to renounce? Or for that matter, there may be one of those out there that, you know, the title at the Bureau of Records says it's got my name on it. That's not mine also. Because over an expanse of time, we enter this world owning nothing, we leave owning nothing, and in between we're busy making things mine. So what is it that's, from a spiritual perspective, what is it that's mine to renounce? So it's incomplete renunciation to give up worldly possessions, but it's a complete form of renunciation to recognize Hari Sambandha Vastuna, those things. Vastu means stuff or things. In relation to Hari, they should be engaged in service to Hari. So here's another example that Prabhupada gives. I walk out side and I see somebody's wallet. Now I can do three things. Just put it down and let somebody find it, because it's not mine. Or no one's looking, so I put it in my pocket and walk down the street. Now I have that much more that I didn't have before, because somebody lost it. Now I found it. And a third thing is find out who it belongs to and return it to them. So a complete form of renunciation is to find the person who belongs to and return it to them. Because it's meant for theirs, their use, their service. And I may be thinking, well, maybe they'll give me a reward if I return it to them. That I'm, you know, I'm honest but a fruitive worker. Just, you know, return it to them. With no condition or no thought in mind other than it should be done to return it to them. So bhakti is like that. What's ours to renounce? But if you have something, I may have some wealth, I may have some ability, may have some intelligence, may have some strength, may have some beauty, may have some renunciation, may have some something. Now, I can renounce it, I could try to enjoy it, or I can offer it to the Supreme from whence it came. That's yukta vairagya. And phalko vairagya is, I just renounce it. Mona Nagababa. No possessions, no home. Live by Madhukari as a form of renunciation. Just accept whatever comes. Or even further than Madhukari is a Paramahansa. If somebody brings something, I'll eat. If not, I'll fast. In America, you'd starve, but in India, you might be, you know, be all right. But where there's a culture that persons that are renounced should be maintained. But the consciousness of giving up worldly possessions is incomplete. Without the prior understanding of what is it that's mine to give up or renounce. Yes. Go ahead.
Maharaj, my question was, in our dealing with other people, we have impersonalistic tendencies and we have personalist tendencies too. I am not clear on how do impersonalist tendencies exhibit themselves in relationship in our dealings with other people, and how do personalist tendencies exhibit themselves in our dealings?
That's a nice question.
If you could just give a certain example, that will help clarify things.
Well, I'd like to take it right to the spiritual platform, because there's the material platform that kind of gets mushy and sentimental and gets kind of lost. So on the spiritual platform, personal tendency goes directly to Krishna. And because Krishna is a person, and the part and parcel living entities are parts of Krishna, so you see the relationship of living beings in relation to Krishna. That's personalism. So now, with personalism, I may very well treat persons respective of their station in life. Like, you know, someone who's a sannyasi, I'll behave a certain way. Somebody who's a small child, I'll behave in another way, appropriate for their circumstance, their social situation. But nonetheless, see them as a spiritual part of Krishna. That's personalism, because it's Krishna-centered. Still making distinctions on embodiment, but not identifying with that's the person. That's personalism. And impersonalism is there's no such thing as distinctions. You know, it's all it's all one. But practically speaking, people don't live by that philosophy. Prabhupada demonstrated that in many ways. One time, someone said, "Swamiji, why do you speak of God? Because after all, everything is one." Prabhupada reached over and grabbed his shirt and said, "Why are you wearing shirt instead of cotton ball if it's all one?" We don't live our lives that way. If it's all one, then let me have you all your money, because it's all one. Your money, my money. We have all your money. We don't live our lives that way. It's not a philosophy by which we live our lives. But so how it manifests itself is neutralizing or denying our individuality, our uniquenesses. We discussed that this morning. And that's a type of impersonalism. But, you know, again, more fundamentally, it's just not acknowledging the relationship of this person or this situation with Krishna. You know, like, let's say, Mother Nature. Not recognizing the relationship of Mother Nature with God. And God's the proprietor, the enjoyer, and the well-wishing friend. It's just up for grabs. If I get my grubby hands on it and get away with it, then it's, you know, it's... Don't break the law and end up in jail. And I'm going to do it because, you know, there's no accountability to anybody. Just up for grabs. He who grabs first wins. That's impersonalism. The whole way of materialistic life is impersonal. There's no accountability. Other than, you know, our man-made laws that are subject to being broken and changed. But God-made law is there. I'm accountable. More?
Just a clarification on the...
Yeah.
You mentioned something about when we do not accept the unique nature of every individual and their unique relationship with Krishna, then
that's a type of impersonalism.
So if you think of it, let me put it in another way. This person is a devotee. Let me use a cookie cutter. He should fit into that cookie cutter. If he doesn't fit into that cookie cutter, he's not a good devotee. Is that impersonalism or is that just immaturity?
Well, it's immaturity. There's standards, and the standards are what they are. But, you know, I may, because of my immaturity, I may be unable to accept somebody as a devotee because I'm not able to see within their heart there's devotion. They're just not evolved in their devotion enough to be at this standard, that standard, or some other standard. It's my immaturity, not necessarily impersonalism. Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you. Was Vyasadeva a grahastha? Vyasadeva?
He was a
grahastha. Would we say that Vyasadeva achieved spiritual perfection? Arjuna. Arjuna sannyasi or grahastha? Grahastha. Ambarish Maharaj. Sannyasi or grahastha? That's right. That's right. On the authority of Bhagavad Gita, also, regardless of one's position.
Bhakti needs sacrifice.
Everything requires sacrifice. But when the sacrifice is unto the Supreme, Bhoktaram Yajna Tapasam, when the yajna, the sacrifice, is recognized that Krishna is the bhokta of that yajna, and that's bhakti.
As your knowledge depends upon bhakti. Hayati bhakti.
Well, it's not that. Yeah, knowledge depends upon bhakti, not that bhakti depends upon knowledge.
Bhakti depends.
Independent.
Knowledge depends on more involvement in bhakti.
Yeah.
As much as knowledge grows.
Yeah, that's right. Anything else? Yes. Hare Krishna.
Bhagavad Gita, today we spoke about Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. So, but we know that the first six chapters, Krishna talks about Karma Yoga and then Bhakti Yoga and then Jnana Yoga.
Yeah.
So why does Krishna actually completely speak so much about Jnana Yoga when Bhakti Yoga is part?
Well, in one sense, you speak real fast and your sense is clear. But aside from that, the whole of Bhagavad Gita is bhakti, and their karma without bhakti is useless, gyan without bhakti is useless, they're not independent, but their components. Detached work is a subset of bhakti. Renunciation is a subset of bhakti. How to work without attachment to the fruits of work, karma palatyag, is a component of bhakti, but it's incomplete. But it's an entry point. First, understand the soul, at least conceptually, and then how to engage in activity without attachment to the fruits of activity. I mean, that's a major challenge for a conditioned soul. I mean, their whole program is fruit of activity. So how to engage in prescribed duties without attachment to the fruits. There's lots of lesson in that one. But to achieve it perfectly, it requires full devotion. And then the other side, again, it's starting from chapter 13 on, it's a restatement of things that were described earlier in a more expanded form. I mean, it's not that the modes of nature are new, chapter 14. Or, you know, the field of activities and the knower of the field of activities. They're described, just the approach is different and more, and expanded. So there's emphasis in that sense on knowledge, or gyan. What the purpose of it is to engage in devotional service to Krishna. So there are angas that are supported by the main message. So the main message throughout the whole of Bhagavad Gita is bhakti.
Yes.
All right?
Thank you.
Okay. I've answered your question, right? Okay.
Yes. It's not too late.
That's not.
We hear many pastimes in Lord Chaitanya's life where so many impersonalists, they surrender, I mean, they completely surrender themselves to the Lord. What would have stirred in their hearts, like,
well, he was a stalwart, a smarta Brahmin. He was a grihastha, but he was a very, very, very learned person. So learned that he has sannyasi studying under him to receive knowledge from him. So what brought about the transformation was mercy, and specifically, it was Lord Chaitanya's explanation of the Vedanta Sutra. It was so brilliant that his scholarship recognized this is not only correct, but the person who's presenting this is not just an ordinary person. Because of his power, of his capacity of knowledge and the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, he was able to understand he's the Supreme Lord himself. He had that realization just from hearing him. Lord Chaitanya smiled and then showed his form, his spiritual form of Sadbhuj, the personality of Godhead in his spiritual form. Prakashananda Saraswati, it was a little different. It was also mercy, These were hardcore Mayavad sannyasis. So he showed his spiritual effulgence, his Brahman effulgence, like blazing like many suns sitting in the same assembly. And they were very attracted to the Brahmajyoti. And he was exhibiting that he's the source of that Brahmajyoti that they're very attracted to. That moved their hearts. And then when he spoke, it moved their hearts further. Because he spoke the truth. But their hearts had become somewhat opened from hearing.
It seems to me that these personalities, they were so high up in their own knowledge that they were able to
receive something
and then transform so quickly.
Yes. What about us?
In our cases, we don't have to.
Those that Lord Chaitanya delivered weren't just staunch Mayavadis. He delivered Jagais and Madhais in all types of people. All types of people. All types of people. Vasudev, the leper, or Kurma, the Brahmin. You know, all types of people. Just a very nice householder. First place when he went on a South Indian tour. First place he visited. Wasn't a big gyani. He wasn't a Jagai Madhai person. Just a wonderful Brahmin. So all types of people, not one type. Muslims, Buddhists, Jains. Impersonalists, sannyasis, grahastas, all around town. Simple village people, highly educated people, all types. And it wasn't all the same approach, but in all cases it was mercy. Yes?
What is the cause for bhakti? Because I think that there should be a certain amount of jnana, at least initially.
The question that you're raising is raised by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in the first chapter of Madhurya Kadambini. How does bhakti begin? He proposes a number of things, but he rules them out also. And the final thing that he accepts is that a Madhyama Bhakta who is carrying bhakti displays compassion and gives some bhakti to someone. And that they are empowered by the Supreme Lord to deliver him through their devotion is what enables it to be successful. That's what's required. Okay?
But for one to become a devotee, at least he should have like realization is the scriptures and things too.
They just have to be a recipient of mercy and say yes. That's all they have to do is just say yes. Have to understand anything. There's that story from Lilamrita where the devotees, have you been to 26 Second Avenue in Manhattan? It's a storefront, and it's a rectangular storefront, so like the front end, there's a glass in the street and a door. And then a long hall, or storefront. And the back was where Prabhupada sat, and to the side was a bathroom. So one time, Prabhupada is seated, and class is going on, and a drunken bum, so drunk he couldn't walk straight, came into the right in the middle of the class, stumbled his way through the devotees, and walked to the bathroom, and took some rolls of toilet paper and put them in the bathroom, and then stumbled his way back out again. And the devotees were, you know, you're disturbing class, and rah, 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 rah. And Prabhupada was very pleased. He said his devotional service has begun. Now, what did he understand? You know, he likes Swamiji, or he liked the devotees, or somebody was kind and gave him some prasadam. So he wanted to do something in return. So he did something he could understand was doing something that would be useful for them. Not understanding, you know, what he was disrupting, he was just trying to do some service. And Prabhupada saw that and accepted it. Preliminary knowledge is not required. Mercy is required. Yeah, go ahead.
The first one kind of connects to this one.
This one or this one?
No, both rather the same.
Okay.
I think you mentioned the verse from Bhagavad Gita that devotional service is the source of the platform of Brahman realization.
It doesn't start at the platform of Brahman realization, it starts on the platform of Brahman. It means it springs from the spiritual platform. To engage in devotional service, there's some spiritual connection immediately, no delay, immediately.
You mean the realization that...
Not realization. It springs from the spiritual platform. It's not from the material platform. Is there another way of saying the same thing? They're saying it in the negative. It springs from the spiritual platform. It's not generated from a combination of circumstances. Material circumstances plus material circumstances equals devotional service. No. It springs from the spiritual platform. And the spiritual platform, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma, it's by nature, the spiritual platform is prasanna. It's joyful, blissful.
Thank you. So, the other question was that in my association with the devotees, one thing that holds me back is for sure my false ego. I'm just too proud to say something, to ask something. And the other thing is that I just think that they need they have a life. I don't want to bother them. I don't want to be a load on them. You know, things like that. Not with pure devotees, just aspiring devotees. So what's the line? How should I know that? Should I ask for a favor or not?
Well, this is a maturity question. That, you know, and it's a humble question. One, you know, you don't want to be a nag and a nuisance, but you want to ask that which is relevant and meaningful, being it's not a nuisance. It requires a little common sense and a little experience. Some persons are lacking in common sense, and some persons are lacking in experience, and some persons are lacking in both. But, so that you're being careful, I'm sure that's appreciated, and, you know, you can say to the devotee or the devotees, if I'm speaking something that's, like, inappropriate or it's just a nuisance, please don't hesitate and let me know. So, you know, a little safety valve has some value. But don't, like, you know, say nothing. The other extreme is not good. Inquisitive spirit is good, and, you know, running of the mouth is not good. So your question is, where's the balance? And a little discrimination and a little experience, some maturity helps. The devotees will guide you and let you know. Okay. Well, 9 o'clock. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Yeah.